Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, it's great to have you tune in today. Thanks so much. I always love the opportunity to get together and have a great conversation with you. And looking forward to today's visit as well. Guest in studio. It's always great. I'm Neil Stavem along with Ted Ross, and Chris is at the phones. And Ted, I got a quote from Mark Twain. Always good. He said, "Actions speak louder than words, but not nearly as often."
And that's a bit of a thinker, huh?
Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "It's one of the most beautiful compensations of life that no man can sincerely try to help another without helping himself," which reminded me of Proverbs 11:25. "A generous person will prosper. He who refreshes others will himself be refreshed." And my guest today has experienced that in his own life, that he has decided that there are some things that he could do to help others, and he's been refreshed in the process, and he's going to tell us all about it in a moment. I just want to say that there is an opportunity for you to help those in need of shoes. Our ministry spotlight this month, interesting group, the shoe that grows.
Sounds like a very interesting concept, and it literally does just that. You can take a shoe starting at a certain size, and it expands up to five sizes as the child grows, because a lot of times shoes that are donated, kids outgrow them, they wear out. But this lasts for a long time, 5 to 7 years.
It's our ministry spotlight here at Faith Radio, and you can find out more about it at myfaithradio.com. Just check that out, myfaithradio.com. And when you're there, make sure that you're checking out all the program schedule and all that. If you're new to Faith Radio, we'd love to send you a welcome packet as well.
That's free. Yeah, sign up for that at myfaithradio.com.
All right. Our guest is not new to Faith Radio. In fact, I've known him for, I don't know, we think 20 years or so, Ward, maybe?
I think so, if not longer.
Okay. Well, Ward Brehm is an entrepreneur, a businessman, and a leader in African humanitarian efforts, and a nationally known public speaker and commentator on relief and development in Africa. In fact, in 2008, he was awarded the Presidential Citizens Medal for his work in Africa by President George W. Bush. And he was appointed to be chairman of the United States African Development Foundation back in 2004. And he spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast back in, what, is that 2008?
Was that 2008.
Right? Yeah. So, which was actually up until that time, they hadn't had just regular guys speaking, right?
Well, they never had anyone from the business community.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's
right. It was the entertainment or faith or so. Still a mystery as to why they picked me, but it went well.
Well, we're glad to have you here. Ward has written a couple books. His latest is called Bigger Than Me. Just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed the questions. And let me just say right up front that we do have a couple of copies of Ward's book that we can give away. And we do a drawing here at the end of the hour, so you can sign up for that at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And if you're in the Twin Cities area, then you maybe know about Ward, because he knows a lot of people, which is, I guess, part of your maybe your calling, right? Just to get to know people and see how you can serve.
Well, I've always placed a high value on relationships, long-term relationships. And I think it's particularly important in today's age where everything seems to be more and more transactional and artificial, not necessarily authentic, but there's nothing better than a long-term friendship and relationship.
Well, I thought maybe to fill us in on your story a little bit. We've sort of teased it out a little bit about African humanitarian efforts, so we know there's a connection with Africa, but thought maybe you could review the chapter in your book that you subtitled, "Can God Change a Jerk?"
The jerk is me.
Yeah.
And it's based upon the sad reality that I woke up one day at the age of 40 years old having really achieved all of the goals that I had in life in a larger way and at a quicker pace than I'd ever imagined, and thought that I would be happy, that I'd be content, that it was the American dream. And instead, Neil, I ended up with this hole. It was someone recently referred to it as a simmering discontent. I had everything that I thought I wanted, but I was lacking the one thing that I really needed. So up to that point, if you wanted an answer virtually on any topic, you'd just come to me and I'd give you the answer. I knew everything. I was very difficult to teach. I was impatient. And some of those things helped me succeed in business, but they weren't helping me at all succeed in life. And so my jerk theory is that if a person goes through their entire life without a singly humbling experience, an on the knees despairing situation, you become a jerk. And we all know the older you get, the jerkier you get. And we all know those people whose world are so small because it's focused only on themselves. And fortunately, now a lot of my friends say, well, what do you mean you used to be a jerk?
Sure. Yeah. Friends like that. Who really needs more
right.
friends?
Yeah. But it had a big impact that it changed
yeah.
my life.
Yeah. It happened. Your pastor invited you to Africa once. Right. And he, maybe just tell a little bit of that story because that really was kind of mm-hmm. the beginning of the change.
Yeah. Yeah. I had gone to Colonial Church in Edina. Arthur Rauner was my pastor. He came when he was 33 years old. I was 15 years old, probably the worst confirmation student he'd ever had. We drifted away. I was a very occasional visitor to church. I would consider myself to be a cultural Christian. Didn't mean much, had no real impact on my life. But we, I don't believe in coincidence anymore, but we went back to Colonial, Chris and I. And on the way out, Arthur pulled me aside. I hadn't seen him in months and said, I'm going to Africa and 3 months, and I'd like to have you come with me. And I said, I can't even believe you'd ask me a question like that. No. And he asked if I'd pray about it. And I said, I looked him right in the eye and I said, look, you're the pastor. You pray about it. You know, I'm going to think about it. I'll either say yes or no, but I'm telling you right now, the answer is going to be no. And it's interesting the way that the Lord works, because I could not get that invitation out of my mind. Mm. I totally dismissed it, and it kept coming back. And finally, I said, I think I'm supposed to go, and I can't avoid it. So I went dragging, kicking, and screaming over to Africa and ended up changing my life. I met the real Jesus in Africa, largely in the faces of the people that I met, the poorest of the poor. Saw things up close that were really nasty. And the greatest gift of all is, on that first trip, I found the purpose for my life, and it was to be an advocate for these people who have no voice of their own.
Which is one of the, I think, the biggest blessings, right, is to when we can actually find it, what it is that we are called to do, right, to find, which I know you're, in fact, Rick Warren wrote the foreword to your book, and his book had some influence on you as well, too, right? Because he starts out, the book is not about us,
right?
Not about me.
I was actually given that book by a friend, and I threw it away because I was done with Christian books. I said, I'm just going to read the Bible, and I went through this kind of phase, and my wife rescued it, and one night had it propped up on my bedstand and said, have you read this? I said, no, and I didn't. I haven't read it. I'm not going to read it. There it was, propped up. I opened it up. First page, first sentence, first page, first chapter, it's not about you. I later told Rick he should have left the whole rest of the book blank because that's a powerful, the idea yeah. that you God has a purpose for your life and that it's not about you is a huge thought. That's a big one.
You spent some time at a retreat center. I was just kind of going through. There's the book is called Bigger Than Me. Just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed the questions. And there's just a myriad of short little chapters, just kind of reflections on various aspects of your life and kind of some lessons learned. But you talk about it. You went to a retreat center to help you realign your life. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, like most of us, you know, I found myself, you know, in this rat race. You know, it's only been exaggerated by huge multiples with all this, you know, cell phone and social media and all these constant distractions. And I'd heard about this place called Patchman Terrace. It's a Franciscan hermitage. It's a retreat that's about an hour north of Anoka. And so I went out there not knowing exactly what I was getting into. But in essence, they take you out to a little cabin in the woods, your own cabin. There's a vow of silence throughout these beautiful woods with paths and lakes, and it was magnificent. And so I got to my little hermitage and opened the door, and I had a couple things to put away. And all of a sudden I realized this is just me and God. I'd like to say it was a pleasant feeling. It wasn't. I felt as though I was exposed. And the next 2 days were really a treasure as when you're alone with God. I came to the realization there's nothing I can do for God. I used to think he needed me. I honestly did. When I first took off on this whole quest in Africa, I was like, you know, God really needs me. And then somewhere along the line, I realized that the creator of the universe probably isn't overly dependent on an insurance salesman from Minneapolis. It took a little while. I was getting over that jerk period. But I started to think, what is it that I could do for God? And what I came to the realization is the only thing that I can do for God is to give him my full attention and my presence and to be alone with him without distractions of any kind for a protracted period of time is good medicine. It's wonderful for the soul. And as difficult as it is to make the commitment to go, what you find is that you come back. It's almost like I've taken a bath. It's like a spiritual retreat, and it's been wonderful. I've done a lot of writing in those woods.
Bigger Than Me is the outcome of some of Ward's latest writing. It's his latest book, Bigger Than Me. Just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed the questions. We'll get to a few of those questions and talk more about Ward's answers as well coming up in a few minutes. Ward's an entrepreneur, a businessman, and a leader in African humanitarian efforts. He was appointed to be chairman of the United States African Development Foundation. We'll find out a little bit about that. He still serves on the board of that. Spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast back in 2008. Cares about Africa, and we're going to find out about how we can care more about what God's doing in Africa as well. And get to some questions. We're going to talk about, not just the retreat center. It's been a couple days quietly before the Lord, but could you pray for 2 minutes every day? We'll hear about Ward's challenge on that coming up in a moment. By the way, we do have some copies of the book, Bigger Than Me, to give away, and you can sign up for that with a phone call at 877-933-2484. 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question for Ward, want to just say hello, you're welcome to join the conversation as well. 877-93-FAITH. I've wondered, is this all there is? You know, that we think the good life is a showy one. Well, in the long run, though, we're going to find out there is more to this life than this life. Ward Brehm has thought through that a lot. One of his great books is Dead Man Walking? Is that the first one? White Man Walking. And the new one just came out, Bigger Than Me. Just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed the questions. Ward's a entrepreneur, businessman, and just got a hold of his life. And he's found his purpose to be a voice for the poor in Africa. He's a leader in African humanitarian efforts. We'll talk more about that as we go along. But, in one of the chapters, you talk about your friend Doug Coe, who was one of the, Christian leaders in Washington, D.C., and he challenged you to pray for 2 minutes every day. That doesn't seem like that big a challenge, but talk about how that changed your life.
Well, it was interesting. I was hugely fortunate to have Doug as a mentor. And I'd meet with him on a regular basis, always challenging. One day we're sitting in the living room on a couch, and he looked at me and he said, "You know, you don't pray enough for it." I looked at him and I said, "What did you say?" He said, "Well, you don't pray enough." And I said, "How could you possibly say that? How would you possibly know?" He goes, "I can tell." I said, "Really?" I said, he goes, "Well, let me ask you a question. Do you pray enough?" And I paused and I thought about it. And I said, "Well, not really. I don't think I pray enough." He goes, "Okay. Well, I want to challenge you. I want to make a deal. And what I want you to do, you can think about it, but what I want you to do is I want you to agree that you will pray for 2 minutes every day on your knees, and that you will also read the gospel any way you want, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the first half of Acts, for 5 minutes. And I want you to do that for 6 days a week. On Sunday, you can take a day off." And I started laughing. I said, "Are you kidding me? I mean, you're talking about 2 minutes and you're talking about 5 minutes of reading scripture. You're talking 7 minutes total. I get to take a day off." He's going, "Believe me, you're going to need it." And so I said, "Okay, you got a deal." And he said, "Okay, well, you promise me that at the end of 40 days of doing this, you'll let me know either way, whether you did it or didn't. Or, you know, you'll probably forget some days." So we made the deal, and I went home, and I was unpacking my suitcase and doing various things. I realized that I'd almost forgotten the first day. So I went into my office, got down on my knees, and closed my eyes, and I began to pray. And he'd warned me. He said, "You know, your mind's going to be filled with all sorts of distractions. Don't let it bother you." He also said, "You need to time it." And I said, "You got to be kidding. Do you need to time it with a stopwatch or your watch? You have to time the 2 minutes." Now I'm on my mind. It's like a safari going through my head. And I'm going, "This is really bad. I mean, I can't focus on God for 2 minutes." And I get going, and all of a sudden I go off in some tangent. But I remember what he said, so I just say, "Lord, sorry, little distraction here or there." I finally got done and got up, and I looked at the watch. It was 45 seconds. So down I went, and I finished the 2 minutes, and then I read from the book of Luke for 5 minutes. That actually went longer. And so every day, I literally had to program myself to do this. It was not a natural thing, and I realized, gosh, how many days had gone by where maybe I didn't pray at all? I mean, if this 2 minutes... You know, I prayed extensively in church. I pray extensively for and with people. But just alone with God, it was an incredible discipline. And after 40 days of doing it on a regular basis, where it became ingrained into my life, into just the routine, it became a blessing beyond measure. In about 6 months, someone asked me about it. And they said, "Yeah, how's that going?" I said, "I completely forgot again." I mean, really, when you think about it, we're supposed to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind. And I'm scratching my head trying to figure out how I can give them 7 minutes. I mean, it's laugh or cry.
Doug had a way of challenging you, as a good mentor should. He also tore up your 10-year plan. Tell us about that.
Well, that actually goes back to a number of medical ailments that I have, which result in a most likely a compromised life expectancy. And so I'm thinking intellectually to myself, what if I knew for a fact that I had 10 years to live? If God said, "I don't normally do this, but I'm going to do it with you, you got 10 years," and would that change my life? And immediately the answer was a resounding yes, of course it would. But then the next question was, how would that change your life? And that was a bigger question. So I actually, being kind of an organized business guy, I wrote a document that was called Ward's 10-year plan. What I had in terms of priorities, specific things that I wanted to get done, things I wanted to do for the next over 10 years before I died. So I had talked to Doug about it, and he said, you need to come out immediately to Washington, D.C. I'm really excited about this. I want to see it and talk to you. So I did. I walked in. He said, did you bring the plan? You know, a twinkle in his eye, and I said, sure did. And I gave it to him. He tore it into a million pieces, threw it on the floor, and literally yelled, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. I can't even believe it. You came up with a 10-year plan? That's ridiculous. He says, what you need is a three-day plan. He said, you need to figure out, if you had 3 days to live, what would you do? And then do that for the rest of your life. And again, the wisdom of that statement really took hold, because it really calls the priorities. And what I realized is that if I had 3 days to live, I would sell my business, which I ended up doing a couple months later. And that I'd grab my kids and I'd put them around me and I'd teach them everything I possibly could. And that was really the beginning of this book.
That's really a challenge for all of us, isn't it? I mean, because we don't know how many years. And I mean, as you said, you've got a diagnosis of compromised health. So you know that there's an end date coming.
Well, my other mentor, Monty Sholin, always used to say, don't miss the privilege of your problem. And it sounded ridiculous at first, but it's so true. You know, every problem, every trial that we have in our lives can result in huge dividends if we're open to listening to the answers and the lessons that God has for us. And I'd say the biggest lesson for me with the various medical ailments that I have is that I'm on notice. You know, I talk to people and they're never going to die. I talk to people 85 years old and they're going, gosh, you know, I'm starting to have a little ache and pain, you know, but nobody is, as I always say, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
We're going to hear more from Ward Brehm in a few minutes, because Ward has made multiple trips to Africa, and he's living his life on purpose, and it's a challenge for us to come alongside as well. And you can learn more about it, be inspired through his new book, Bigger Than Me. Just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed the questions. Well, let me get to a few more of those questions. We're also going to talk a little bit about the bracelets. Ward wears bracelets. And we'll talk a bit about true riches, all those things, and you know what it means to really be comfortable bringing up the name of Jesus in a conversation. Ward Brehm, entrepreneur, businessman, and leader in African humanitarian efforts. He spoke at the National Prayer Breakfast in 2008, advocating for the poor in Africa, National Prayer Breakfast, and he received President's Citizens Medal for work in Africa by President Bush, honored with that distinguished medal in 2008. So we're going to talk more with Ward in a moment. We do have some copies of the book, Bigger Than Me, to give away. Love to put you in the drawing for that. And give us a call at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Looking for an adventure, well, then you need to look bigger than yourself. And that's the title of Ward Brehm's new book, Bigger Than Me. Just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed the questions. But it's about finding our purpose, our place in life, God's plans for us, and a deeper purpose and meaning. You're going to get inspired if you pick up a copy of Bigger Than Me from Ward Brehm. Ward's a businessman, entrepreneur for the past, I guess, 20-plus years or so, has been going to Africa. In fact, Ward, you wear bracelets on your wrist, and I saw you a few months ago and was asking you about the bracelets. Did you one for each trip? Is that what they represent?
Well, Neil, I went to Africa the first trip with Arthur Rauner in 1993. And I saw poverty on an obscene level. I saw some things that really just broke my heart that actually, in retrospect, I think I was asleep without even knowing it. And Africa woke me up to the needs of the poor. And it was actually a 3-week trip. And at the end of the trip, I realized that when I went home, how is this going to square? So I took a bracelet from each of the countries that we'd been in, Ethiopia, Uganda, and Kenya. And I put them on and I made a solemn oath to God that they would never come off, it would be a permanent, tangible, that this was real. Because I knew when I got back to Minneapolis in my business suit and this would be, I promise, they'll never, ever in my life come off. I wasn't planning on going back. I went back the next year and decided to add one. And added one each year that I went back until I had 8. And I realized that it was starting to impact my golf game. There was too much weight on the right hand. So I just made a deal with God. I said, no more, no less. This is it. And this is
a book about priorities after all, right?
This was before airport security. So it became a bit more of a sacrifice as time went on because I'd always get held up, of course, and get the wand on and so forth.
Talk about those trips to Africa and you know, what you saw then and maybe what you see now, because it led to you, being appointed as the chairman of the United States African Development Foundation, which people probably have no idea there is one of those. Mm-hmm. And so talk about your work there and what you saw.
Well, it's interesting, Neil, how God works, because I knew then in the mid-90s, I'd go back at least once a year. Was working with World Vision, Opportunity International, a number of humanitarian organizations, and had another conversation with Doug Coe, who asked me the question, if I was God, how would you help all those poor people over in Africa? And my mind went totally blank. I had no idea. And I said, I'm not God. And he said, well, we got plenty of time. Think about it. I couldn't come up with an answer. And I finally got exasperated. And I said, look, you be God. You tell me, what would you do to help all those poor people? And he said, I'd change the hearts of the leaders of those countries. And the truth of that really resonated with me. And it totally shifted the focus from doing, working with the poor on a local basis to trying to have some type of an influence with the leaders of Africa. So I went over with Senator Rod Grams, later with Senator David Durenberger, Chief Justice Paul Magnuson, on trips where we were able to meet with the leaders of these countries and talk to them specifically about being servants, following Jesus, nothing to do with Christianity, but rather what would Jesus have you do? And the Senate, a lot of people don't realize, but the United States Senate has about 30 to 40 senators that meet every Wednesday morning, both Republican, Democrat, of every religion, every denomination possible, and they meet and they pray together. It's a little time out. So we went around all over Africa setting up these little groups of people to meet, again, privately around the principles and precepts of Jesus. As part of that, and spending more time in Washington, I developed some relationships and deep friendships with members of Congress, one of whom suggested that I lead this agency. It might be the smallest government agency of all, the USADF. It's also one of the most potent because it was actually formulated in 1980 by Senator Ted Kennedy. The idea is to fund the entrepreneurial ideas of Africans themselves rather than impose solutions. It's you come up with your own solution, and if we think it has a shot, we'll fund it. So I served for 6 years as chairman. President Obama reappointed me, and now I'm serving under the third president. So it's been very interesting, and we've made a lot of progress.
And is that progress, again, using the entrepreneurial model where, you know, you're not going there with a handout, it's more of a hand up?
Yeah, I've changed my philosophy on that considerably over the last 10 years. and it may sound harsh, but it's true. Anything that anyone does to try to help the poor in Africa that doesn't have a for-profit motivation behind it, it won't work. It's the same set of incentives that we use here. So if Walgreens was dependent upon donations, they'd be out of stock of virtually everything. So our most recent innovation, an experiment of type of sorts that's actually working, much to our surprise, was done in conjunction with the American Refugee Committee, representing the private sector, and the USAID, the largest aid arm of the U.S. government, where we actually developed a way to distribute basic medical care, clean water, and nutrition using a for-profit business model. And in a nutshell, we rely on donations. Again, the government's matching private donations. We use donations to pay for the infrastructure, the water systems, the clinics, the machinery, and the first 3 years operating expenses. And then after that, the good will continue to go with no more donations. The problem right now, and I saw it firsthand in Eastern Congo, is that the second the money stops, the good stops immediately. The food chain is immediately stopped, often for reasons that have nothing to do with the recipients, the poor people. But they're out. They're out of drugs. They can't get the clean water that they need. So this is really exciting. We actually have four zones up that treat probably 15 to 30,000 people per zone, and they're actually cash flowing. So it's really encouraging.
You know, you talked about, you know, meeting with the leaders of these countries. I know, as you share in the book, Bigger Than Me, you had conversations where you brought up the name of Jesus into the conversation fairly regularly, even maybe to the surprise or shock of some of your hosts. How did you decide to be more comfortable doing that?
Well, Jesus, you know, Jesus says, "Lift up my name and I'll attract men." And I always go back to the fact that He does the attracting, but we have to be bold enough to lift up that name above them all. I had a fascinating experience with the difference between Christianity and the name of Jesus. It was in Rwanda. President Paul Kagame had taken over immediately following the genocide that totally destroyed the entire country. Over a million innocent Rwandans were massacred. And Senator Dernberger and I had the opportunity to meet with him. And in the course of our conversation, talking about the socioeconomic impact and all the things going on, there's a little lull, and I just snuck in, well, Mr. President, is there any role for the church in the rebuilding of your country? And he'd been pretty pleasant up to that front. And now I saw the military general. His eyes were glaring. He leaned over the table, pounded the table with his fists, and he said, "There is no place for the church in the rebuilding of our country. The church was complicit in the genocide. The Christianity failed our country," and I'm getting little gentle kicks from Dernberger underneath the table. And he quickly switched it over to railroads or shipping or some less contentious topic, and you know, the president kind of settled down, and there was another lull not long afterwards. And I said, "Mr. President, do you think that there might be a role for Jesus in the reconciliation of your country?" And I got a pretty good kick under the table from my buddy, and it was amazing. Neil, I'll never forget it. The president totally relaxed, sat back in his chair, huge smile on his face. And he said, "Well, of course there's a role for Jesus. If the people of my country had been following Jesus, this never would have happened." And it was just, again, a very tangible example. And I've had them over and over and over again where if you want to talk about Christianity or you want to talk about religion, in a lot of these places, you'd be very poorly received. But Jesus is welcome everywhere. He opens doors. It's the name above. Again, you can say spirituality with no problem, anybody can talk about that. You can mention God without really any little tougher. But Jesus always, the name of Jesus always gets a reaction. Sometimes it's bad. Sometimes it's amazing, but there is always a relation. And my theory is it's because that name has such great power.
Ward, if we, as you said, if we were following Jesus, truly following Jesus, what difference would that make? How would we maybe see our what true riches are, and our responsibility for a continent like Africa?
Well, I always used to. Once I knew Jesus, once I committed my life to trying to follow Jesus, I really actually started thinking I was getting, making some pretty good progress. Mm-hmm. And then one day I realized as I read these stories that had I not known the ending, if I would put myself in the crowd, I probably would have been against him every step of the way. The woman at the well. I mean, we all know how it turns out. We know the story so well. We know the good guys and the bad guys. But I'm saying, had I not known how the story, he was a revolutionary. He went against against every conventional wisdom, and he went after the most were religious leaders. And what I found in my own life is that people who have left the church or have left their faith, or they don't have a faith at all. A lot of times, it isn't due to Jesus; it's due to people. Churches are made up of people just like us, and people say, "Well, the church and these and the whole thing's hypocritical." And I'm saying, "Yep, actually, it is." And when I think about it, the greatest hypocrite that I know is me. And so, when Jesus said, "Who wants to throw the first stone?" I mean, when you really think about that and put yourself in that story, that stone goes back in your pocket pretty quickly.
We're going to take a quick break and come back, talk a little bit more. One of the chapters in Ward's book, he did a little word study, and we're going to learn more about words like believe, pray, love, and give. We'll see. We'll have Ward do the math for us coming up in a moment. Ward Brehm, entrepreneur, businessman, and author of the book Bigger Than Me. Just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed all the questions. Talking about how we live life on purpose, with meaning. Bigger Than Me is the book we've been referencing, and the subtitle is Just When I Thought I Had All the Answers, God Changed the Questions, written by Ward Brehm. Ward's in studio today. Ward, you did a little, one of the chapters, did a little study looking at the number of times the word believe shows up in the Bible, 289. Pray, even more, 367. You get the love, 696. And then the word give shows up 1,433 times. That was that suggests that, I guess if number of words count, that we probably need to pay attention to that a little bit, don't we?
We sure do. Jesus, I always thought Jesus talked more about the poor in his 3 years on earth than any other subject, and he actually did, except for one, and that was money. Mm-hmm. He spoke to the issue of money more than any other. And it's also interesting that Of all of the sins, of all of the shortcomings we have, money is the only one that he actually advised to beware, because there's a tremendous amount of spiritual blindness that comes to the way that we think about money, particularly our own money. So I started thinking about that, and I started to think about the fact of how generous I am. I give a lot of money away. Chris and I give a lot of money away. We give a lot of our time away, and we're having this conversation. And when I read about the rich people making a big show of giving their giving, and Jesus saying, well, they gave out of their these people gave out of their wealth, but the widow who put two pennies in is giving out of her poverty. And I read that about three times, and I came to the realization that never in my life have I made a gift or a donation so large that it prevented me from doing something that I wanted to do. Never have I made a gift so large that it had a significant impact on my life that could come anywhere near being called sacrificial, so that I'm giving out of my wealth. Well, then you say, well, I'm not really wealthy, and that's fascinating to me because I've asked so many people, I'll be around a table of people, I'll say, who around here considers themselves rich? Nobody raised their hand. People worth $100 million, $500 million, nobody raised their hand. And I'm not raising mine because I'm looking at the guy over there, right, who's got 10 times as much as I do. And that's the spiritual blindness, is that people who are wealthy are people who have more money than I do. When in fact, if you make $25,000 a year, which is slightly above the poverty line in the United States, or if you have $50,000 in accumulated assets, you're among the top 20% richest people in the world. So the fact of the matter is most people living in America are extraordinarily rich. You're in the top 20, 10%, 1% of people in the world. So the next question becomes, whose money is it? And I came to the realization that in my own life, I always thought it was mine. I earned it. I worked hard. I made sacrifices. I made good decisions until my mentor Monty said, well, the best decision you made was being born in Edina, Minnesota to two really great parents. How'd you swing that one? And so when you think about it, everything that we have is a gift. So the notion of self-reliance and this, you know, strong Marlboro men and women are going to go out and just get this thing done, and I did it, you know, don't need nobody know how, is silly. I love the fact that I can't remember, it was a bumper sticker, but it said, the problem with a self-made man is that he worships his maker. And I see that so often when, in fact, we're just playing Monopoly. All these things that we think are ours are all going back in the box.
So how do we find true riches? What's your challenge today for us to really, you know, come home to that realization?
Well, Jesus did a pretty good job of describing true riches. I mean, he told us very plainly on numerous occasions, you know, don't store up in barns, you fool, you know. Rather than try to accumulate things on this earth, think about storing up your heaven and treasure, which is it makes practical sense. We're here, we already know. I mean, I don't know about you, but this life's gone by really fast, so this idea of my being a wisp, I'm embracing that. Versus eternity, which is for all time. So the idea of being eternal, focusing on eternity. And what are those riches and where do they come from? They come from helping other people. They come from being able to communicate Jesus in such a way that he can find himself into other people's lives. You know, we all talk about money and the things that it can't do, and it's all true. I've never heard anyone on their deathbed, you know, talk about one more deal, you know, or one more sale or about any. What they really talk about are relationships and friendships and faith. So it's the primary reason that I wrote this book is that there are so many big issues in life, ego, self-absorption, all these different big issues. And these are issues I've struggled with my entire life that nobody really talks about. So I'm trying to throw them into the open.
As you've done well on the book, Bigger Than Me, just when I thought I had all the answers, God changed the questions. We do have a couple of copies to give away. We'll do a drawing here in about 5 minutes, so you can sign up for that, 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Ward Brehm, entrepreneur, businessman, and seeking to speak up on behalf of the poor in Africa. Appreciate you coming by today, Ward. Good to see you again.
No, thanks for having me down here. It's really good to be with you guys.
Blessings to you. And we're going to share just a little thought about appreciating our pastors coming up in a moment. Stay tuned.
All
Hi, this is Jim Daly from Focus on the Family. As we celebrate Pastor Appreciation Month, we're reminded of the daily pressures on pastors and their families. Research verifies that over time, these daily stresses take their toll on these servants, often bringing discouragement, frustration, and even depression. We may have no idea of the tremendous pressures and loneliness they may be experiencing. So take an opportunity to send a special note of appreciation and love to your pastors this month. And remember to pray for them every day.
Not too long ago, we had a chance to talk with Leith Anderson, of course, who's a regular guest on our program here on Connecting Faith. And we talked to him as a longtime pastor of 35-plus years about, you know, what should we do to appreciate our pastors during Clergy Appreciation Month?
You're right that appreciation shouldn't be limited to October, and I'm not quite sure why pastors have to share the month with Halloween.
That's, that's a good question.
You know, you're right. Why just October? It's sort of like telling your wife on Valentine's Day once a year, I love you. It's a good idea to do it more often. The obvious expressions of appreciation, you know, they're a kind word, a nice note, maybe a gift. But it's good to consider some other ideas. So how about these? Put a reminder in your calendar to send a note or a gift or something in April or in August when other people may not be doing it. And maybe you'll be the only one, and that's really positive. That's really good. And how about showing appreciation for conversations with your pastor where you ask some questions, questions that are sort of non-threatening, non-political, non-theological, maybe even non-pastoral, I don't know. Ask about growing up or favorite teachers or last year's vacation or a favorite movie or a dream car, because pastors want to be acknowledged as persons and not just as pastors. And express appreciation for the pastor's spouse. Being married to a pastor can be a really tough assignment. So show appreciation for the underappreciated spouse. And if you really want to show appreciation in a way that's going to make a big difference, then encourage the church to be generous with salary and benefits and days off and vacation, because there are so many pastors who struggle financially, who work long hours and get discouraged, and they don't feel comfortable raising those issues with the leaders of the church. So they just don't say anything. And that means appreciation can be just advocacy for the pastor. And advocate for the pastor when there are critics in the church. You know that all leaders get criticism, and pastors get maybe more than most. And many of their families and the pastors, and they can feel pretty beat up, and they don't know how to handle difficult people. So show appreciation by being the pastor's protector. And I would say to someone, if you are the pastor's critic, kind of just shut up for a year and give the pastor a year off. And that would be a nice way to show appreciation.
I think, indeed, that's not bad advice at all. I was curious, Leith, if you write a note, should it be something specific? Or, you know, just, hey, really appreciate you, how you're leading the church? Or is specificity really valuable?
If you can think of something specific that's really positive, I think that's good to do, like a specific sermon. I found in conversations with people, sometimes I'm surprised by what they say they most appreciate. They say things like, you know, I saw you in the supermarket and you remembered my daughter's name. And mention that in the note. But also, before you seal it and mail it, reread the note and think of it in terms of the pastor reading the note and how the pastor will read it, not just how you wrote it.
Leith Anderson, of course, was a longtime pastor at Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, for some 35 years, and now is president of the National Association of Evangelicals. And giving us just some encouragement about Pastor Clergy Appreciation Month, which is all month. And, of course, as he said, you know, I don't know why it has to share it with Halloween.
Do it all year long.
Sure, that's right. It's always a good idea to appreciate your pastor. And we certainly appreciate Leith, and we'll get back to him here in a couple weeks when he swings back with us. And enjoy the conversation with Ward Brehm, businessman, entrepreneur, really just a humble servant of God, and appreciate all that he's doing. You'll be able to catch that interview again, listen to it. We'll post it here on the show page, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. That'll get up here after the show. And tomorrow, talking true identity, Joe Bender talks to John Majors from Family Life about their Passport to Identity curriculum. It'll be a great conversation here on Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. And you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.